This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Students should only participate in psychological evaluations on a voluntary as opposed to required basis. Despite these issues, Corey's contract was renewed 13 times without public discussion or review of any other applicants. In a public letter to the Portland City Council, longtime activist and political consultant Joanne Hardesty urged the city not to renew its contract with Corey. In her letter, Hardesty encouraged Mayor Charlie Hales and Police Chief Mike Reese to work with the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform to conduct a broad-based public search process to replace Dr. Corey.
The nation's largest banks shifted their foreclosed properties to emerging mortgage services in a trend expected to make up the bulk of testimony regarding Senate Bill 558 at the Oregon State House on Tuesday. Crafted to address gaps in last year's foreclosure protection bill, a provision intended for credit unions and community banks appears to provide opportunities for other types of lenders that have not to date been active in mortgage servicing. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with consumer advocate Eric Kankler about an article he penned on behalf of Economic Fairness Oregon.
The original impetus for Senate Bill 558 was, it stems back to the passage of Senate Bill 1552 in the 2012 session. That bill was focused on There's two branches of foreclosures. There's non-judicial foreclosures and judicial foreclosures. And the non-judicial foreclosures were the industry norm at the time, and that's what that bill anticipated addressing. So it required pre-foreclosure mediation for non-judicial foreclosures. After that bill went into effect, and also stemming from a relevant court decision last summer, the industry shifted almost completely to judicial foreclosures, and as a result, basically bypassed Senate Bill 1552's requirements. So the primary point of the Senate Bill 558 this session is to extend the pre-foreclosure mediation opportunity to both judicial and non-judicial foreclosures.
Any idea how many homeowners would be impacted by this shift in ownership of the mortgage servicing?
That's going to depend on the magnitude of the shift. What I can say is some rough math at present suggests that an exemption level of 175 could leave out as many as one out of five homeowners facing foreclosure. Another way to put that is if you look at the current suite of servicers, those that process 175 foreclosures or fewer are doing about upwards to 20% of the volume at present. That number is going to increase to the extent that the exemption is exploited as a loophole, but just how much is impossible to say at this point. One way or another, it's going to result in an impact on thousands of homeowners.
And that's just in the state of Oregon?
Correct.
For folks listening to the discussion that we're having, if they want to learn more, if they want to get involved, who do they call? Where do they go?
Well, there's a couple things that they can do. One, I've laid out much of what you and I have just talked about on blueoregon.com, and I've got that has some links to some of the institutions that we're talking about. It has links to the bill. It has links to the public hearing. I would encourage people to go and look at the legislative website as well, and to look at Economic Fairness Oregon's website. We have some resources up on the site, economicfairness.org, and they can learn more about that on the website.
Any organizational opposition to closing this loophole testify tomorrow?
I would presume some pushback from the banker lobby, frankly. Industry opposition is another way of putting that.
Would that be the Bankers Association?
Oregon Bankers Association, yes. They've been the primary point on this issue.
I want to thank you for your time.
Absolutely, and thanks so much for the opportunity, Robin. I appreciate it.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
Earlier today, the Oregon House passed Senate Bill 491, which allows minors over the age of 14 to seek mental health treatment from professional counselors and family therapists without parental consent. Bill 491 modifies an existing bill that was passed in 1985. The original statute allows minors 14 and older to obtain treatment from a list of qualified professionals, and Bill 491 adds to that list. Legislators who spoke against the bill argued that the original bill carried flaws that should not be expanded by this new amendment. Representative Conger spoke in opposition to the bill.
Under the existing statute, there is no requirement for the provider, the mental health provider, again, listed in the existing statute and expanded by Senate Bill 491. There's no requirement until before treatment is terminated. How long does treatment go on? There's no requirement for parental consent until treatment is terminated. It could be a year. I mean, I really don't know. I think it's too vague. And interestingly, the testimony we had in committee was very consistent from mental health providers that, in fact, parental involvement is desirable for treatment. Well, that pretty much says it all.
But supporters of the bill say that while it might not be perfect, it has worked for the past 28 years. Representative Kenemer spoke about the existing bill.
So I think the proof in part is in the pudding. It's been working. It's not ideal. And part of the reason I think our committee chose not to try and repair it in the moment, it's a difficult issue to articulate. How do you really define when the appropriate time is? You know, when you have an abused child, you don't want them to have to go to their abused parent and say, "Dad or Mom, I need therapy because of what you've done to me." That is not going to work. On the other hand, do we want parental involvement? Yes. So I think we need some time to thoughtfully examine the underlying statute, decide if there are appropriate ways to update it. But I think it's an appropriate bill, and it's not an effort to undermine parental rights at all, and I urge your support.
Representative Kenemer further addressed the issue of parental consent earlier today.
Certainly not all parents are good parents, but most of them are. And frankly, most good therapy is going to involve, if it involves a child, it's going to involve the parents. And pragmatically, frankly, most of the time, if you're going to go and let parents know that you're seeing their child, you probably had best do that quite early rather than late, unless there is some all-consuming reason. So I think in a lot of ways, this takes care of that.
Ultimately, Bill 491 passed and will now be sent to the governor for signing.
The Oregon House heard public testimony today on a bill which would create a universal health care system in the entire state. So far, Vermont is the only other state in the country to offer health care to everyone living in the state. A report in New England Journal of Medicine praised the system that was put into place about 2 years ago. The report says that Vermont's universal health care system is exceptional for its level of transparency, independent monitoring, and cost savings. In the state legislature in Oregon today, several dozen people signed up to testify, most of them in favor of a single-payer health care system for the state. Here is a sampling of some of the testimony.
My name is Bud Laurent. I'm the chair of Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates, and I appreciate the fact that you're holding this hearing today and that so many of you showed up, I think all of you at one time or another, to participate. While Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates understands that this is a courtesy hearing with no subsequent action intended, many of our advocates will be in attendance, as they have been, filling up this room and two others, to express our support for complete healthcare reform in Oregon that leads to what many refer to as a single-payer system. Our advocates, and there are growing numbers of them, are convinced that a well-administered single-payer system, much like a Medicare for all, is the only thing that makes sense, humanely and fiscally. Oregon is on a path to health care reform, currently limited to lower-income Medicaid patients, for which we applaud the legislature and other state leaders for enacting. Within the promise of the newly created coordinated care organizations lies the possibility of a much-needed change in the delivery system in the form of patient-centered primary care medical homes. While these are estimable achievements, Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates knows that they are only a beginning. To achieve fully reformed health care in Oregon, we need to pass a bill like 2922, and we're grateful for the 24 representatives and the three senators who have signed on as sponsors and co-sponsors of the bill. They are heroes to us. We look forward to a time at a not-too-distant day when there are solid majorities in both state houses in support of single-payer health care for all Oregon.
The year is 2013, and we live in the United States of America. My name is Nadine Gross-Kowiak. For 17 years, I had been employed as an emergency trauma RN and have worked in over half the emergency departments in Oregon as an agency nurse. I currently am a very hard-working owner of two nursing businesses, and I cannot afford health insurance. The story I'm about to tell you is playing out as we speak. A very nice 58-year-old gentleman presented as a patient at the Corvallis Community Outreach Medical Clinic a few weeks ago with symptoms of increasing weakness and fatigue. I happened to be the volunteer nurse that checked him into an exam room. I took his vital signs, a brief history of his symptoms, and noted that he had significantly low blood pressure. He was then seen by the volunteer MD, diagnosed with a virus, and sent for lab work. He was instructed by the doctor to return in 2 weeks for his lab results and follow-up. He did exactly as was asked of him. He returned to the clinic 2 weeks later in decidedly worse shape. In fact, he was very pale and slumped over on a bench. He was unable to hold his body up. I once again checked him in, took his vital signs, and again noted a significantly low blood pressure. What ensued were long back and forth conversations about the bills he was going to incur from the ambulance and the emergency department. A compromise was made and a taxi was called to transport the patient to the hospital. Not in an ideal situation for a critically ill patient. My main concern was that he would die waiting for that taxi. He was diagnosed that day with esophageal cancer with metastases to his liver. Who knows if this otherwise healthy 58-year-old gentleman could have avoided the progression of his cancer had he been lucky enough to have insurance and the ability to access quality medical care and receive a diagnosis much sooner or even preventative health care. Desperately sick people do seek medical attention eventually. Usually it is too late. This is a tragically sad commentary. When did we as a country become so morally bankrupt that we could fail to take care of the sick and injured in our communities? When did we decide as a culture to put profits for the very few far above and beyond the health care of our entire nation? As a nurse, I should never have to decide against what is best for my patients because they cannot pay their bills.
Just one of the reasons we Mad as Hell doctors are mad as hell is the number of Americans, approximately 40 to 50,000, and Oregonians, estimated at 660, who die needlessly each year, not to mention the even greater numbers who suffer ill health needlessly in America. With respect, in my opinion, the current huge efforts using the community care organization incremental approach to fix the terribly inept healthcare non-system in Oregon has already clearly proven to be, as predicted, fractured, and recently more and more contentious, particularly over issues of transparency. House Bill 2922 is the solution. Thank you.
Those were members of the public testifying in favor of a universal health care system at the Oregon House of Representatives today. The bill still has to pass a committee before it goes to the full House for a vote.
A coalition of local groups led by Occupy Lake Oswego are currently holding a protest at the Walmart store in Tigard. They have also been joined by groups opposing the new Walmart development in Sherwood. Over the course of the last year, Walmart has seen its reputation and business practices questioned amidst bribery allegations, tragedies in its supply chain, and turmoil amongst its workforce. This includes several strikes launched last year for the first time in the company's 51-year history. Since 2011, Walmart has seen a decline in its reputational index rating, while its competitors have seen an increase during the same period. Last fall, more than 30,000 supporters joined striking workers on picket lines on Black Friday. And since then, a number of actions have taken place at Walmart stores across the country.
You were listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's show will look into employment for individuals involved with the justice system. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to have intermittent clouds and sun throughout the day, with highs near 69 degrees. The evening should see partly cloudy skies with lows around 50 degrees and the sunset at 8:30 p.m.
It is 5:20, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If corporations are people, as the Supreme Court pretends, they certainly are loudmouths, constantly telling us how great they are and broadcasting their brand names everywhere. Amazingly, though, these corporate creatures have suddenly turned demure, insisting that they don't want to draw any attention to themselves. That's because, in this case, corporations are not selling, but buying. Specifically, trying to buy public office for their pet political candidates by funneling millions of corporate dollars through such front groups as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. In turn, the corporate fronts use the money to air nasty attack ads that smear the opponents of the pro-corporate candidates. Why do corporations need a middleman? Because the ads are so partisan and vicious that they would appall and anger millions of customers, employees, and shareholders of the corporation. So, rather than besmirch their own names, the corporate powers have meekly retreated behind the skirt of Republican political outfits like the Chamber. But don't front groups at least have to tell election authorities who's really behind their ads? No. Thanks to the Supreme Court's infamous Citizens United Edict in 2010, such groups can now pour unlimited sums of corporate cash into elections without ever disclosing the names of their funders. This dark money channel has essentially established secret political campaigning in America. This is Jim Hightower saying that's why shareholders and other democracy advocates are asking the Securities and Exchange Commission to rule that the corporate giants it regulates must reveal to shareholders all political donations their executives make with corporate funds. After all, that's shareholder money the executives are using to play political games. It belongs to all shareholders, not just a few CEOs. For more information and action, go to www.commoncause.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The editor-in-chief of Bloomberg issued an apology Monday morning after the company accessed the private information of its clients throughout its financial information services. Journalists working for the financial news service were able to see who accessed the financial news terminals offered by the company and furthermore see what categories they browsed. Federal regulators have announced that they will investigate whether or not journalists spied on Federal Reserve officials. Bloomberg, owned by billionaire New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, offers market data to clients through its proprietary network of terminals, which comprises the main portion of its business. Reporters were able to see who was logged on into the terminals and if they were browsing news or information regarding stocks, among other features they could monitor. After an official on investment bank Goldman Sachs complained of the reporters' access to restricted information last month, the access allowed to reporters was terminated.
The Associated Press has learned that the Justice Department has seized 2 months of the company's telephone records. The records contain information concerning the incoming and outgoing calls and the phone numbers of AP reporters and sources. They also include the personal phone numbers of reporters working across the company's operations in New York, Connecticut, and in the House of Representatives press gallery. The Justice Department has records of all calls made from April through May of 2012. The AP sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder protesting the seizure of records, saying it is overly broad. Press sources have speculated that the investigation may pertain to a May 7, 2012 story that mentioned a terror plot in Yemen thwarted by the CIA. The story included details about CIA operations from a confidential source. In sworn testimony this February, the director of the CIA said he had been questioned by the FBI as to whether he was the source of the leak, a charge which he denied. In all, the records of 100 reporters were obtained. The Justice Department has been criticized in the past for being too aggressive in punishing government whistleblowers, bringing 6 cases against people alleged to have leaked classified information.
A 60-year-old fourth-generation Oklahoman was arrested this morning in a lockdown to protest the Keystone XL pipeline. Bob Waldrop walked onto an active construction site for the Keystone XL pipeline in Semioli County and locked himself to an excavator, which is a piece of heavy machinery used in the construction of the pipeline. He told reporters that he decided to take action to, quote, defend the land and the creatures that depend upon it to survive. Waldrop is a part of the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance, which is a growing coalition of groups and individuals dedicated to stopping the expansion of tar sands infrastructure throughout the Great Plains. His action followed an escalating number of work-stopping actions, including 5 in April alone in Oklahoma. In a statement, Waldrop said that the Keystone XL pipeline would destroy ecosystems and habitat. He also stated that the pipeline's owner, TransCanada, is violating the rights of indigenous people of the area, whose treaties are being abrogated by the company's profit.
Boeing announced today that it is cutting 1,500 jobs. According to the Seattle Times, the jobs slated to be cut are mostly in Boeing's information technology, or IT, department. The cuts will take place over a 3-year period through layoffs, attrition through retirements, and the relocation of some positions from the Puget Sound to Missouri and South Carolina. According to Boeing, staff that volunteer to be laid off will receive severance packages. In March, Boeing said its strategy is to cut a percentage of its nearly 8,000 IT workforce nationwide in an attempt to outsource more than 50% of its IT work. That month, Boeing said it would shed up to 2,300 jobs from its commercial wing, and it dropped 40 employees who work in the company's military operations. The company said last month it would eliminate 1,700 engineering jobs from its commercial aircraft division. In related news, Boeing will continue to halt 787 flights on May 20th. A series of battery fires caused the Federal Aviation Administration to ground the 787s last January. Boeing has insisted that the cuts are unrelated to losses incurred while the planes were grounded.
The U.S. Supreme Court today ruled in favor of agribusiness giant Monsanto in a patent dispute. Monsanto sued Indiana farmer Vernon Bowman over his use of weed-killer-resistant soybean seeds for 7 years without paying royal tithes to Monsanto each time he planted a new crop. Monsanto's policy dictates that farmers cannot reuse seeds derived from their patent-protected strains. Farmers are required to buy an entirely new batch of seeds every year. Bowman failed to do so, instead cultivating each new crop from the seeds his soybeans had produced the year before. The central legal issue in the case was the concept of patent exhaustion, or the doctrine that the patent's owner's jurisdiction over a given product after the authorized sale of that product. Monsanto argued that the patents extends to the lifetime of an organism, including its reproductive cycle. The company argued that an agreement signed by Bowman governed not just the seeds he purchased, but the trade of herbicide resistance. The court, which decided unanimously in favor of Monsanto, agreed with this argument. They ruled that farmers must pay not just for the initial seeds, but for the right to use what Monsanto calls the technology of genetically modified soybeans. In this case, the court upheld the idea that products like seeds, software, and the cell lines used in biological research are a type of technology, subject to different rules than most individual goods sold to consumers. The Supreme Court says that today's decision is not a global ruling on the question of patents on such products, but a narrow ruling on seeds patented by Monsanto. The ruling affects a wide swath of American farmers, since about 90% of soybean farmers use Monsanto's patented seeds.
In New Orleans yesterday, 2 or 3 men opened fire on a Mother's Day parade, wounding 19 people, including 2 children. Media coverage of the attack has been sparse, and major media agencies have not called it a terrorist attack. The FBI has claimed the shooting was a result of street violence and not terrorism. Despite the similarities with the Boston Marathon bombing, which included attacking a large public gathering and targeting civilians, there has not been a similar national response to the killings this weekend. While some analysts have blamed the disparity on the fact that the New Orleans attack was gun violence instead of a bomb, other commentators have pointed out the difference in coverage may be connected to race. In Boston, most of the victims and the perpetrators of the violence were white, while in the New Orleans mass shooting, the victims and shooters were mostly African American. No arrests have been made as of today.
The Boston Globe newspaper has published an editorial supporting the decision of Stephen Hawking to boycott a conference in Israel. This makes the Boston Globe the first paper in the U.S. to respond with anything other than harsh criticism of Hawking for his participation in the global call for academics to boycott Israel. The Globe article says that the decision to withdraw from the conference is a reasonable way to express one's political views. Observers need not agree with Hawking's position in order to understand and even respect his choice. According to the newspaper, Hawking has signed on to a movement which aims to place pressure on Israel through peaceful means. The author said that in the content of a Mideast conflict that has caused much destruction and cost so many lives, nonviolence is something to be encouraged. In the latest action on the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which is trying to pressure Israel by economic means to adhere to international law, students in New York held an action today outside the headquarters of TIA-CREF. TIA-CREF is a fund used by teachers around the country to invest in their retirement, but many of the companies that that TIA-CREF invests in are connected with Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Elena Krivo-Kaufman with the We Divest Coalition spoke this morning on Cable's Air Cascadia about today's action.
The We Divest campaign, and today in New York is a really exciting day for the We Divest campaign, which is a national movement to divest from the Israeli occupation. And here in the U.S., we're working on this by targeting TIA-CREF, which is one of the largest financial services institutions. And so we're pressuring them to divest from companies that profit from the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. And today's a really exciting day in New York City because students all across New York from different colleges, Columbia, NYU, Hunter, the CUNY schools, are delivering a message to the TIA-CREF headquarters today in New York at 4 p.m. That students are the future, and they are calling on TIA-CREF to divest from all companies benefiting from the Israeli occupation. So it's a really exciting day, and they're actually delivering a message from students across the country. So throughout the winter and the spring, students across the country from 23 different schools took part in actions at their local campuses to call for divestment, for specifically telling TIA-CREF that students are their future, they're their future clients, and students are the future of this movement, and are calling on TIA-CREF to do the ethical thing. They claim to be a socially responsible company, and so we are calling on them to live up to that. So it's an exciting day here in New York, and we'll be delivering the message to TIA-CREF, student demands around investment specifically, as well as a really beautiful banner, which brings together the images of the 250 students across the country who have been doing these actions at their local campuses.
That was Elena Krivo-Kaufman with the We Divest Coalition in New York. More information can be found at the website bdsmovement.net.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, May 13th, 2013. Israeli troops attack West Bank communities, leaving injuries as settlers attack Palestinian villagers, homes and cars. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
Palestinian sources reported on Monday that a group of extremist Israeli settlers attacked and destroyed Palestinian property, destroyed graves, and wrote racist graffiti in a Sesuiya village south of the northern West Bank city of Nablus. The sources said that the settlers destroyed a hut house and two agricultural tractors that belongs to resident Abdel Aziz Nasser, and also attacked and defaced a number of graves in the village and wrote racist graffiti on them. On Sunday evening, several settlers hurled stones at dozens of Palestinian cars at the Shaveh Shamron junction near Nablus, causing excessive damage. No injuries have been reported. Also on Saturday evening, a Palestinian man was injured after being attacked by extremist settlers who invaded the Burim village south of Nablus. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Monday at dawn several Palestinians, including an imam of a local mosque in different parts of the occupied West Bank, after violently breaking into their homes and searching them. Moreover, Israeli troops also invaded the Jenin refugee camp in the northern West Bank city of Jenin, kidnapped two Palestinians identified as Raed Amin Dabiyya, 36, and Mohammed Amin Zbaydi, 38, and took them to unknown destination. Local sources reported that more than 20 military vehicles invaded the camp approximately at 2 after midnight and fired dozens of rounds of live ammunition, gas bombs, and concussion grenades during clashes that took place with local residents. The sources said that an exchange of fire took place around the home of Dabiyya before he was taken prisoner, and that several injuries have been reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, May 13th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 50-